It's Diane. On my mind, understanding the roots of anti-black racism. The murder of George Floyd sparked what many referred to as a racial reckoning in this country. But to make progress in the conversation, my guest today argue it's useful to look back at when and why the concept of race was invented in the first place. In a new book titled, Who's Black and Why?, renowned scholars Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Andrew Curran unearth a hidden chapter from the 18th century invention of race. The edited volume pulls together essays commissioned by the Bordeaux Royal Academy of Sciences in 1739. They trace European intellectual thinking about racial classification and the struggle to justify the treatment of enslaved Africans. Professor Gates, Professor Curran, you have just edited a collection of essays written all the way back in 1741 that you say illustrates a turning point in the evolution of defining race. Talk about the Bordeaux Academy and their essay contest. Professor Curran.
Well, thanks. First, it's an honor to be on the show this morning. The Bordeaux Academy is a typical 18th century institution that was created in the context of the Enlightenment. They were interested in progress and helping humans theoretically. And they were also very interested in kind of these proto-anthropological questions. And they were worried about the kind of the question of blackness, which is a preoccupation in Bordeaux. You have to imagine this, these are 40 men, elite members of Bordeaux society. And they sent out this question all over Europe. There was a time when science was claiming the right to decide these big anthropological questions. They were pulling back this from the church, and they sent it off to all sorts of various people across Europe, and even people in the United States and North America were getting interested in this as well.
And 16 essays came in between 1739 and 1741, written in French and in Latin from as far away as Sweden and Ireland and France, of course.
So what exactly, Professor Gates, was the question that they wanted these essays to respond to?
Well, the question was, what are the causes of the blackness of the skin of the African and the texture of the African's hair? And it's hard now, Diane, and let me say, it's good to see you, old friend.
Thank you.
You're looking fabulous.
Thank you.
It's hard now not to marvel at the audacity of the essay competition, because while various explanations related to the origin of black skin had been circulating in Europe since antiquity, the 1741 contest was the very first time, Diane, that a scientific academy extended an invitation to Europe's best thinkers to envision an entire subspecies of the human community in terms of separate genealogies, categories, varieties, and even aptitudes. And the results are fabulous. I've prepared a kind of a summary for you. Shall I share that?
Sure.
Well, there was a lot of disagreement about where Africans came from among these essays. They're fascinating to read.
And remember,
Diane, these essays, because no winner was chosen, these essays were then put in the Bordeaux archive and then transferred to the library in Bordeaux. And they've sat there since 1741, and never translated until we published this book last week.
Now, let me ask a question. How come no winners were chosen?
Well, I'll tell you that.
Fascinating.
I'll explain that after I share their theories.
Okay.
Some religious thinkers maintain that either Adam or Eve was black. Some postulated that there were separate Adam and Eves, that there was a white Adam and Eves for Europeans and a yellow Adam and Eves for Asians and black Adam and Eves for Africans. Others said that black skin was a mark of God denoting sinfulness. A number claimed that God made white people initially, but that this original group had degenerated, that's a key word, into black people due to either a brutal climate or poor food or a bad air. Two more maintain that blackness was a God-given gift to allow people to live in what they called the torrid zone, the equatorial areas of the earth. And one of the more earnest authors lamented the fact that black Africans had a moral defect in their parents, which had led their children to be turned black. There were also some early scientific explanations. One author stated flatly that Africans were black because black men had black semen. Several mentioned the fact that blackness results from the color of the blood and that Africans had darker blood due to the effect of air. And another anatomist claimed that Africans had a special black bile circulating in their bodies or were the product of the black sperm of the father. But Diane, my favorite of all time is that white women produce black children when they think about an African male or the color black during the sex act.
Indeed. And wasn't there one anatomist, I believe, in Haiti, Professor Curran, who stated he found all kinds of differences between blacks and whites internally?
Yeah, his name was Barrère, B-A-R-R-E-R-E, and he was actually in French Guiana, what we would call French Guiana right now. And he was a surgeon working on a plantation, and so he had access to many enslaved Africans, particularly their cadavers after they died. And so he was seeking out the source of blackness in a way that people who were back in France were not doing, in that he had an actual kind of access to anatomy. And of course, there's a number of people who are involved with this kind of activity, and they would find structures that, of course, don't exist in African bodies, but they were so obsessed with finding something like race that they would identify these structures. Eventually, in the 1750s, they were talking about black brains, black pineal gland, black sperm, and this became one of the most important criteria for the classifiers who came online in the 1770s. And so it's really interesting that the Bordeaux Academy did get this guy to start thinking about this. He had been a surgeon, as I said, and he came back to France, and then he wrote his essay. It was a one real, truly empirical essay that was based on kind of physical knowledge. And this really was a change in the way that people were talking about what we now call race.
Now, as you say, Professor Gates, we are talking about essays done in the mid-18th century. Mm-hmm. At the same time, was anything like this going on in this country where blacks had already been kidnapped from Africa? Was anyone in this country investigating why skin colors were different?
Yes, there wasn't an essay competition, but there was a great deal of speculation in the 17th century, the late 17th century, that is, the late 1600s, about Diane, not so much the cause of blackness of the African, but what it signified about the African's place in the great chain of being, the African's place in the animal kingdom. And it's horrific for us to contemplate this, but there were real questions about whether Africans were human beings or if they were animals. And I lecture every year about a man who graduated from Oxford. He became an Anglican priest. His name was Morgan Godwin. He came to the United States and he published a pamphlet in the year 1680. So that's basically 60 years before this competition, adamantly declaring that Africans were human beings, not animals, and therefore they should be baptized. He said they shouldn't be freed, but they should be baptized. And Diane, he said there were four reasons that he knew they were human beings. And these are the four. One, that they could engage in trades. Two, that they could read. Three, that they could write. And fourth, my favorite, is that they possessed the capacity to laugh, risibility. And he said, only human beings can do these four things. And he knew Africans who had done these four things. And therefore, this horrible aspersion that had been cast on a whole continent of people should be relegated to the dustbin of history. They should be recognized as human, though inferior. They should be baptized, but they should be kept in slavery. And these attitudes, you know, and if we look at overall at the nature of the responses, half of them said that blackness was a result of climate. And some were, many actually were very concerned to remain consistent with biblical scripture. So that they insisted, A, that there was one Adam and Eve, so that, but obviously they thought the baseline would be whiteness and blackness would be a degeneration of falling away from that whiteness. And several said that they followed the, it's starting in the Middle Ages, there was a widespread myth that blackness was a result of the curse on Ham. And you remember that Noah had three sons, and Noah gets tanked on the ark, and he's naked, and two of his sons refuse to look upon his nakedness, but Ham, his third son, does and mocks him. And God punishes Ham, not by a curse on him per se, but on a curse on his son, who was called Canaan. And the Bible says that Canaan was then therefore doomed to be a servant unto servants. And that, starting in the Middle Ages, and then, of course, through the Renaissance, becomes interpreted as a curse of blackness, because being a servant is conflated with being of African descent, though we know the word slave itself was from Slav. You know, it had Slavic descent because so many slaves were Slavic. So the pressure of the growing slave trade demanded a biblical interpretation for why these Africans were punished by God and doomed forever to be slaves in Europe and the Mideast. You know, we have a very accurate count of the number of Africans shipped across the Atlantic to the New World between 1501 and 1866, and that number is 12.5 million. But we don't have an adequate count of the number of Africans shipped north across the Sahara and shipped east across the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean. But many scholars estimate that cumulatively, far more Africans were ripped out of the heart of Africa in both of those slave trades, which began long before the transatlantic slave trade, of course, but continued through the transatlantic slave trade.
Professor Curran, tell me how you all came upon these essays published in Bordeaux, how you came upon them. They must have been falling apart when you found them.
So it's interesting that both Professor Gates, Skip, and I have been thinking about these essays for a long time. In a previous book I wrote about 4 or 5 pages of them. And I think I saw them as really this super important kind of fulcrum point in the history of race. And so on my own back in Bordeaux, I consulted these for this book I was talking about. And I was absolutely astonished. People had written about them, alluded to them, and said they were not significant, because they didn't kind of fit in nicely with a kind of really linear history of where race came from, because it was one slice of time. It was 1741, and there were so many contradictions. And for us, this is the fascinating thing, that there was a huge debate on who this subspecies was. And that's why we kind of decided to do it. Now, about the condition, they are in pretty good condition, actually, considering, because the quality of paper in the 18th century is so much better. It's made out of cloth as opposed to paper. And so a lot of the foxing you see and the kind of the oxidation you see in 19th century paper or paper now is terrible. But in the 18th century, it's all in pretty good shape.
We came upon this idea in two completely separate streams. Karen Dalton, who was the editor of the Image of the Black and Western Art Project, came to me over a decade ago and told me about this essay competition. And Diane, my, you know, hair is not very long, but it stood straight up, because this is the black equivalent of the Dead Sea Scrolls. In the history of race science, these are the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the fact that they had been lost, that, you know, only a handful of scholars knew about them, and obviously she had seen references to them in some scholarly tomes that only a handful of people had ever read. And she said, no one has ever thought about or succeeded in translating them. So why don't we do that? So I said, you know me, I was on it like white on rice. I said, we got it. We're going to do this. And unfortunately, Karen had a stroke. Now, thank God she recovered, but she was no longer able to be an active intellectual partner with the project. So I just put it on hold. And by the way, if you look at the dedication page, we have dedicated it to Karen C.C. Dalton, my dear, dear friend. Now, my PhD dissertation at the University of Cambridge in the English department is about ideas of race in the 18th century. And I've only published bits and pieces of it. And I decided, well, it was time 40 years later to blow the dust off and publish it. So in the intervening, I wrote it in 1978. In the intervening years, there are hundreds and hundreds of secondary sources that didn't exist when I wrote my dissertation. So I've been gathering them. I'm in my kitchen upstairs in my wonderful library. I have a whole wall of books about race. And I did a literature search to see if anybody had mentioned the Academy of Bordeaux essay, and Andrew Curran had. I ordered his book, and there was a special issue of a journal in which three or four scholars responded to Andy's book. Andy, what journal was that?
That was H. France.
Yes, that well-known best-selling journal. And so I printed it out. I sat in my living room, his football game was on. And I sat there reading it, and I realized that Andy had written about, you know, half a dozen pages about it. And I immediately reached out to him, and I said, man, this is your lucky day. Let's make a deal. Let's partner. And he responded immediately. It was love at first sight. And I, of course, am a professor at Harvard, and I reached out to my friends at Harvard University Press. And the pitch was one page. I mean, they all got it. This is the Dead Sea Scrolls of Race.
Tell me about the pages, Professor Curran, that you wrote that caught Professor Gates' attention and made him light up like a Christmas tree.
Well, I can't speak for exactly how he reacted to it, but what I can say is that, we both agreed that this was really a seminal moment in how race was kind of coalescing at the time. And the Academy had claimed the right, as I said earlier, to kind of come up with a contest that would bring Europe's best thinkers together. There's a guy in Virginia who was, you asked about the effect of this all over the world. And there was a man in Virginia who was too late. He probably got the call for papers the following year. His name was John Mitchell. And he sent a 50 or 60 page thing to the Royal Academy saying, this is too late. Not to the Bordeaux Academy, but to the Royal Academy in London. So I had discovered that this contest had really made people talk about this in a way that hadn't happened before. And they were talking about it in coffee houses, we found out. They were talking about it in scientific academies. It really was the moment where people had decided to start thinking about this from an entirely scientific point of view, moving away from religion toward more of a kind of scientific or naturalistic view. And that's kind of what I wrote about in the book.
And Diane, you have to remember that race as we understand it today hadn't been formulated quite as a concept, though Francois Bernier had introduced the word race in the body of what we call scientific literature in 1684. Generally, what we call race, which is a misnomer anyway, was called either species of man, the varieties of man, national character, nation, or peoples. And it didn't get formulated in the pernicious way that we have received it today until after 1750. Now, scholars disagree about who did it. Nina Yablonsky is the great anthropologist at Penn State University, is very adamant that it's Immanuel Kant, who in 1775 published an essay called exactly of the different human races. And then she says, and I'm quoting, Kant was the first person to formally define races because he classified people into four fixed races, which were arrayed in a hierarchy according to color and talent. And that, of course, is what we came to associate. And with Africans being at the bottom rung of the human community, or even more perniciously, at the top rung of the animal community, and Africans being so deficient in all that makes a human human that they were thought to be fit by God or nature with a capital N or biologically to be nothing more than slaves.
nothing more than slaves in this country and in other parts of the world.
That's right. And they said that God or nature, Andy's right that this is the end of these biblical explanations. That's why we surmise the Academy didn't make an award. They said, look, we don't know what blackness is, but we know what it's not. And it's not the curse on Ham. And it's not because they live in the equator. Though these interpretations, these explanations would continue even to this day. There are racists who think that black people are black because of Ham looking on his father's nakedness, but they're at the fringe, or because of the proximity of Africans to the sun, as it were, on the equator. So we came up with a phrase, which is a quote from W.E.B. Du Bois to describe this moment. We call it the dusk of dawn. It was the end of a long period of religious and pseudoscientific speculation that then ushered in this period of race science, which was also pseudoscientific, but it masqueraded under and had the legitimate moniker of being scientific. And the greatest minds in Europe all agreed about the lowest status of the African in the human community. And that includes every facet of the Enlightenment, the Scottish Enlightenment with David Hume in his essay of national characters, the German Enlightenment with Immanuel Kant in an essay he published in response to Hume in 1764 called "On Observations on the Beautiful and the Sublime," in which he has a whole chapter called National Characters. Thomas Jefferson, in Notes on the State of Virginia, he said horribly racist things about black people. They were ugly, they were stupid. And Diane, he even goes so far, Thomas Jefferson, the man who wrote All Men Are Created Equal, even says that orangutans and African women mate. And then Hegel, on the philosophy of history, says that Africans are not equal to any of the other members of the human community because they have no writing, they have no history. So the American Enlightenment, the Scottish Enlightenment, the German Enlightenment, they all agree. I mean, these are the smartest people in the world, right? But they all agreed that these Africans were either subhuman or inferior to other human beings.
Now a quick break. When we return, the rest of my conversation with Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Andrew Curran. We're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Andrew Curran, editors of the new book, Who's Black and Why? So, Professor Curran, have we made progress in our understanding of what race is, beginning with that contest back in Bordeaux so many centuries ago? Where are we today with our understanding of what race is?
Well, I think that one of the things we're trying to do in this book is make the history of race part of the curriculum. I think that's pretty amazing. When we were doing an event recently, kind of asked the audience if they knew that race really kind of coalesced around 1750, and the word didn't really even exist before that. And most people in a very educated audience had no idea. It's something we just don't talk about. We talk a lot about the history of racism and the history of slavery, but the history of race is something that really can free us, I think, on a significant level. I was teaching a class in a prison program this past fall, and most of the students who were interested in this class, which was a history of race class, were African-American or Latino, about 90%. And at the end of the class, I asked them what they thought about we read kind of early galleys of the book, and they found it incredibly emancipatory to look back in time. And as one student said to me, it was all BS. We were able to kind of deconstruct where this all came from. And it was something I think that it is very important, with the important parts of this book. Now, whether we've made progress is a different story, right? So here we are today. And I think there are a lot of the vestiges of a lot of these pernicious ideas are in the arsenal of the alt-right and are being deployed very effectively by people to divide. So race has always been around. It changes. It's like a virus. It changes shape over time. It mutates. It's not the same thing as it was in 1750. It's not the same thing as in 2022, but it's still, something is still there. The idea that you can determine people's worth with these kind of abstract categories of four or five different people. So alas, it is still there. But I think that one of the things we can do is talk about where it came from. And once you understand that it's totally invented, that could be a help. I'm not sure what Skip thinks about this. I'm sure you've got some better ideas too.
Oh, no, not better at all. There's nothing wrong with the scientific exploration of difference. We all want to know why people look different and the ways in which human community evolved. That's fascinating. The problem comes when values are attributed, characteristics are attributed to biological difference. That is when we get in trouble. Because if a difference is biological, short of gene splicing, what can change it, right? If that is your nature, and you know this, horribly anti-Semitic things said about Jewish people, anti-Asian things said about Chinese people, things about Irish people, things about Scottish people. I mean, we have about Arabs. You know, we have all of these stereotypes. And when they're tied to biological essences or biological differences, we are in trouble. And that is particularly dangerous and has been remarkably fraught for centuries when this discourse has been applied to people of African descent because of the history of slavery. One of the things my wife, Mariela Iglesias, pushed Andy and me to do was to go back and examine the biographies of the 40 members of the Academy to see what their relationship to the slave trade was. And at first we said, well, they didn't have any direct relation, right, Andy? And it turns out that they were, even the Academy itself had direct and indirect relations with the slave trade, not all, but many. And the city of Bordeaux was the second most important port in France involved in slavery directly and in the byproducts of slavery and the slave trade. Andy, could you elaborate on that a little?
Yeah, to get back to kind of the direct links between Bordeaux, slave trade, science, which is this kind of this triangle, the Academy in 1726 decided that in years where they did not give a prize, where the contests were not adjudicated, they would redistribute the money, take it, and invest in the Compagnie des Indes, the Company of the Indies, which was a big slave trading company. So when we discovered that, having been pushed by Marielle, you know, we were just actually, you know, there it is. There's the kind of the direct link between the Academy and the slave trade there. The elite members were aristocrats, so they couldn't actually get their hands dirty. But there was all these kind of indirect links. Cousins, stock shares, all sorts of things where they were actually directly involved with the whole thing. So,
how true is it that each and every one of us has some blackness within us?
Well, it's true that if we trace our ancestry back 50,000 years, all of our 50,000th great-grandmother and father were walking around in East Africa. And the last time I checked, the people there were black. So the theories of degeneration were right, except everybody was black, and then the other colors evolved from that. But if you take a commercial DNA test, those tests only measure your ancestry back 500 years.
Right.
So unless you're doing being analyzed by a professor, my colleague and friend David Reich, who's one of the world's experts on ancient DNA, you're not going to have any. Diane, I've known you for a long time. I've looked in that beautiful face. I don't see much blackness in there, baby.
But if you went back to my Arab ancestors, indeed, I'm sure you would find blackness.
Oh, that's true. You know, we forget that the Moors, quote unquote, ran what we call Spain, Iberia, for 800 years. And, you know, there's Africa and there's the Strait of Gibraltar, you know. and as I mentioned, the Arab slave trade across the Sahara was huge and went on from time immemorial. So that, and there was even one of the people I write about, I'm fascinated with, El Negro Juan Latino. Now, you don't have to know Spanish to figure out what color he was. El Negro Juan Latino was the first person of African descent to publish a book of poetry in any language. He published three books of poetry between 1573 and 1585. I have first editions upstairs. Friends of mine gave me his three books for my 60th birthday, and it's a treasured volume in my library. And he was a professor at the university. And he married one of his students, as a matter of fact, a white woman, and there are many jokes about him teaching her Latin to conjugate to love, you know. But there was a continuous Black presence. One of the things that you can see from the image of the Black in Western art is that there was continuous contact between Black-skinned people in Africa and white-skinned people in Europe from the Greeks and the
Romans. So here is my question to both of you. How do you hope that the research you've done, the understanding of these essays written back in the mid-18th century, how do you hope that that may change our thinking about the word race? We are so bollocksed up about the word race in this country, but truly in other parts of the world as well. Professor Curran, how would you answer that question?
Well, I think the first way I'd answer that question is to say that race is so directly tied to the European investigation of the African that takes place in the 18th century, and an enormous shift that takes place not only between kind of religious thinking to secular thinking, but Europeans saw Africans for a long time as perhaps, quote unquote, backward and so on and so forth, but they saw them as autonomous with their own kind of forms of government, forms of worship, and so on and so forth in Africa. And when the colonies come online in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century, the understanding of the African from the Caribbean is superimposed on Africans in Africa. And at that time, what happens is there's a lot more Europeans living in the Caribbean than there are in Africa. Very, very few Europeans in Africa compared to what's going on in the Caribbean. There's tens of thousands of Europeans living with millions of Africans there. And they come up with these racial typologies there. They've come up with slave laws, and they come up with labor-based understandings of the African. And so they would say that people from Benin are like this. People from Ghana are like this. They're good for certain activities. These people are better for the field. These people are better domestics. And all of a sudden, these ideas are superimposed on Africa. And then when people are going to Africa, they're no longer thinking about these people as independent Africans. They're thinking about them as potential enslaved peoples. And that's the big shift that takes place. And then race happens at the same time. So we're telling a kind of a multi-layer story here in this book, I think. About this significant shift that's taking place both on the level of the science itself, but also on the level of everyone understanding this and thinking this. It's also a time where literacy is changing completely too. So as more and more people are reading these ideas, as I say, take off like a virus within Europe.
The two things that it's hard to add to that brilliant summary that my friend Professor Curran just rendered, but the two additional takeaways that the history of race science, the history of speculation about the biological nature of phenotypical difference is coterminous with economic exploitation of the African continent. It was either explicitly part of it or implicitly part of it, but it is the subtext for all of this racial science. And the second thing is, in a way, they were right about theories of degeneration. They just got it upside down. The world was black and then became white. And But despite the fact that the out of Africa theories are generally accepted in terms of human evolution, at the level of the genome, we are 99.99% the same. Despite our superficial differences of hair texture, shape of nose, thickness of lips, color of skin, we are fundamentally the same. And that anyone who tries to erect differences and attribute them either to God or to nature or to biology is engaging in a pernicious act of sabotage of the unity of the human community. And we can't repeat enough that race is a social construction tied inextricably to the slave trade.
Now, a final question for you both. This whole notion of teaching about race in schools that has been banned in some states, specifically Florida, critical race theory. I'd be interested in how you think this book may fit in to our learning, our understanding, and how it should be taught.
Well, the attacks on critical race theory, quote unquote, are a scheme invented by certain forces on the right to interrupt the integration of the school curriculum, which has been going on steadily and in an equitable and a very responsible, intelligent way since the late 1960s when fields such as African-American studies were created. What they're trying to do is tar under this scare quotes of a theory that was born in law schools, brilliant theories invented by people like Kimberly Crenshaw and her colleagues. But they're saying that all attempts to teach African-American history in the curriculum are critical race theory. And it is a conscious plot in order to turn back the clock. But we can't teach American history. We can't even teach world history without adding the contributions of people of African descent. We can't teach American history from the very beginning without talking about the role of Black people, the role of women, the role of other people of color, and certainly the role of Native Americans. So this is a trick. It is a retrograde action trying to turn the clock back to when the curriculum was all white and full of white men. And that's just, we can't let that happen. Critical race theory is different than African-American studies. And we should never forget that. One of my books has been put on the banned list in Texas. I mean, I can't believe it. And it's a chronology. All it is saying these are crucial events in African-American history between the 16th century and the 21st century. I wonder if they even read it.
I'm going to give you the last word, Professor Curran.
I agree that this is really a bait and switch move to kind of essentially kick a huge chunk of African-American history out of the curriculum. I would say there's, you know, regarding our book, you know, this is not a theoretical perspective at all. And I think for people to take a look at this, we're going to have to actually confront some real documents as well. And I think that is something that is irrefutable, that we're looking at this chunk of time that people will have to grapple with in a way. So I really can't say much more than what Skip said about this. This is a really kind of a political kind of move. It's been a very effective political move, and it will be an effective political move during the next election.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with me today and talking about this extraordinary book. Thank you both.
Thank you,
so
my friend.
Much.
Thanks so much.
That was Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Andrew Curran, editors of the new book, Who's Black and Why? A hidden chapter from the 18th century invention of race. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.